It's a real pleasure to welcome Will here today. As I think most people around the table will know, some may not. Will used to run this joint. He was a former senior vice president here at the Legatum Institute. First ever employee, I think, of the Legatum Institute is probably right.
It's been all uphill and improving since then, so anyway.
Will put together the crack team that started this place, and I think Will will agree the team wasn't quite complete until we recruited a fresh-faced young researcher, British talented researcher in April of 2009, to come and work here. We're going to have, a fairly informal discussion today. I know that Will's keen to take questions afterwards, but Will and I were just talking, and we agreed that, Will, you're not going to talk for any more than sort of 2 to 3 hours, right?
That's right. I mean, we'll be done by 5 o'clock, okay. I promise.
Great.
We'll start taking questions at 5 o'clock.
Fantastic. Excellent. So, Will will speak for about 20, 25 minutes, and then we'll have plenty of time for questions afterwards. Please do feel free to eat. Help yourself to tea and coffee during that. By way of introduction, Will serves as the Executive Director of the William P. Clements Jr. Center on History, Strategy and Statecraft at the University of Texas in Austin, which was launched, I believe, in January of this year. He's also a distinguished scholar at the Strauss Center for International Security and Law and an assistant professor at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. You can tell I haven't memorized that, I have to read that out, but a long list. Immediately prior to that, Will was here at the Legatum Institute, as I mentioned, and then before that was the Senior Director for Strategic Planning on the National Security Council at the White House. This afternoon's title is American Foreign Policy in the Age of Transitions. Before we get into that, let me just say a few short words about the Institute and the work that we do here. I'll start with the Prosperity Index, which is our signature publication. We are actually due to launch the 2013 edition of the Prosperity Index in just a couple of weeks. I can show you last year's edition, which you're very welcome to pick up a copy of. There's probably some around the room here, if not in the reception on the way out. And then in at the end of October, we'll be launching the 2013 edition. So along with the Prosperity Index, we also run a program on transitions. Our head of that program is Anne Applebaum, who I'm sure most of you will recognize. Anne's a Pulitzer Prize winning author and columnist at the Washington Post. She heads up our work on global transitions. And we also have a program on cultural study as well, and looking at the role that culture plays in prospering countries. Our most recent event in that basket was an event looking at the life of Coco Chanel last night. And there was a lecture on the life of Coco Chanel, which I told my wife about last night, and she was very disappointed I didn't attend because they were actually giving out free bottles of Chanel No. 5. That was our most recent event in the cultural basket of activities that we do. I'll hand over to Will in just a second, he's going to talk about he's going to give a comparative overview of the Bush and Obama administration foreign policy, in particular how both have responded to different transitions that have taken place in recent years. So without further ado, Will.
Okay, thank you very much, Nathan, and it's wonderful to be back here. This is a real treat. As I was telling Nathan earlier, one sign of the progress and growth of the Legatum Institute is more books and a more fully stocked library than when I was here before. So just one of many indicators of great success. So, and it's good to see a number of old friends and some new ones as well. My remarks today are going to be coming out of my dual roles as participant observer. Nathan mentioned I spent a number of years working in the Bush administration on foreign policy at both the State Department and the White House. And while there, I puzzled over a number of changes I saw within Bush foreign policy as President Bush and Secretary Rice and others tried to respond to global transitions they saw. Then when I was over here in London watching the beginnings of the Obama administration foreign policy, now as in many ways an outsider, an expat living overseas, someone who's outside the government, I also puzzled over how the Obama administration was handling a number of global transitions, especially the advent of the erstwhile Arab Spring. We can decide on what we're going to call it now. And then as a historian of American foreign policy, as I've looked at American presidencies in the past and how they handled global transitions. And so my remarks today are part of an ongoing work in progress as I'm trying to make sense of this and look both how American presidents learn and change while in office, and for the non-Americans among us here, and all of you who are living outside the United States, I hope there might offer some insights here. How do we make sense of American foreign policy, which is a perpetual puzzle and in some ways a source of frustration, I know. But then also on this theme of transitions, how presidents react to global transitions, particularly as that being one of the topical themes here at the Legatum Institute. And I think my key takeaway is that when changes take place in American foreign policy, they just as often take place within an administration as they do between administrations. This is one way of making sense why I think there are a lot of expectations globally, for good or for ill, that when President Obama became president, that there would be a dramatic change from how the Bush administration had handled foreign policy. And in some ways there were, but a lot of ways there weren't. And I think, rather, if we want to look at the last 10, 15 years of American foreign policy, the bigger changes have almost taken place within an administration rather than at the points of administrative change and new presidencies. And these, I think these points, even though I'm using Bush and Obama as case studies, they apply. You can look at the transition from Harry Truman to Dwight Eisenhower, the transition from Jimmy Carter to Ronald Reagan. I think you see these across a lot of American presidencies. So first what I'll do is provide my typology or my summary of the different phases of the Bush administration foreign policy keyed to global transitions, then my typology of the different phases of the Obama foreign policy. Of course, look forward to taking these up during Q&A and see if these resonate with some of your own observations as well. And then I have a couple concluding thoughts on how and why presidents do handle global transitions. So during the 8 years that Bush was president, I identify four distinct phases of Bush foreign policy. So whenever I give a talk on Bush foreign policy, I say the first thing to know is there is not a Bush foreign policy. There was a series of Bush foreign policies in the plural, I think four different phases, and each one keyed to a global transition point. The first phase of Bush foreign policy, I think, took place from his inauguration in January of 2001 on up to September 10th, 2001, a day you'll all understand why I pick. And I call that phase nationalist pragmatism. This was where Bush was following a foreign policy somewhat similar to that followed by his father, George H.W. Bush. A focus on strengthening the American national security infrastructure, reforming the Pentagon, doing ballistic missile defense, striking a grand bargain with China, preserving more American freedom of action on the global stage. You might recall the controversial withdrawal from the Kyoto Climate Change Treaty. But no real major robust grand strategy overall, just kind of a prudential pragmatism. Of course, then the major transition point of the September 11th attacks come, and this is where the second phase of Bush foreign policy takes place. I call this America Unleashed. And for especially for critics of Bush foreign policy, this is the phase that most sticks out. This was certainly the most controversial phase. This is the one where there still is the most notoriety attached to it. And this took place, I think this is about a two-year phase. It's from September 11th, 2001, on up to about the fall of 2003. And I'll get to that as a transition point in a moment. But the main features of this are the Bush doctrine that says that states that harbor terrorists will be treated as the terrorists themselves, the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq under the preventive warfare doctrine, this whole war framework for fighting against terrorism, saying, "Oh, there's a legal element, but really it needs to. It's a war on terror." This is when the famous or infamous, depending on your viewpoint, warning of the axis of evil, of rogue states and weapons of mass destruction regimes targeting Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. But then, I think in the fall of 2003, the Bush administration foreign policy enters its third phase. And chronologically, this is the longest phase. This is the one that goes almost 3 years from the fall of 2003 until the summer of 2006. And this is the one we can call the Freedom Agenda phase. And it's in response to a number of global transition points. First, there's the color revolutions. The Rose Revolution in Georgia in 2003, Orange Revolution in Ukraine, Kyrgyzstan, the Cedar Revolution in Lebanon. So there's these populist uprisings around the globe, these inchoate democratic revolutions, and the Bush administration is trying to respond to these and try to make sense of them. Meanwhile, you also have the global transition of the crisis in Iraq. And by the fall of 2003, the Bush administration does start to realize they've got a crisis on their hands because a number of their assumptions for the invasion had been wrong. There were no weapons of mass destruction found. The light footprint decapitate the regime and then withdraw strategy didn't work because an insurgency breaks out. And there's a real question the Bush administration is facing of what kind of government will be left behind in Iraq. What is the post-conflict stabilization and reconstruction plan in Iraq? So it's a combination of these transition points of new democratic opportunities from the color revolutions, as well as the very severe deterioration in Iraq. And so these middle 3 years, I think, are in some ways the most idealistic of the Bush administration. Exemplified by Bush's second inaugural address, where he calls, you know, for ending tyranny in the world. But it really begins in the fall of 2003 when he gives a very ambitious speech to the National Endowment for Democracy, saying that the old order in the Arab world will no longer work. That there's a hunger for better governance. There's a hunger for self-governance in the Arab world. That past American support for autocratic regimes in the Arab world has not worked. The Iraqi people want elections and want democracy. So all these streams are converging, and in response to global events, Bush decides that he's going to make his major grand strategy the promotion of democracy and accountable government and human rights around the world. And this is also tied in with the war on terror. This is now a couple of years after the September 11th attacks. The initial response had been, you know, largely kinetic, of trying to capture and kill as many jihadists as possible, particularly going after the core al-Qaeda leadership. But this is where the Bush administration started asking herself, what causes the terrorists? What are the longer-term roots of radicalization, and how can these possibly be ameliorated? And one of the diagnoses that the Bush administration came up with is, well, it's partly because of lack of opportunity, lack of channels for pluralism and freedom of expression in some of these countries where terrorists are being produced. And so we also need to support democracy and human rights in these countries as more peaceful paths of expression and as a long-term counter-radicalization measures. And undergirding all this is a strategic calculation that conditions within a nation shape its external behavior. And the corollary to that being that democracies are more responsible members of the international system and are less likely to cultivate radicalization. So all these strategic calculations are going into shaping this third phase of Bush administration foreign policy. And we can talk some more about the details on that in Q&A, Tim, if you'd like. But then this also changes, and this starts to change in the summer of 2006, and this is where we come to the fourth phase of Bush administration foreign policy, which I call Back to the Future, or a subtext of Bush the Son returns to Bush the Father. This is where in the last couple years of the administration, I think George W. Bush starts following a strategic profile similar to that followed by his father's administration, George H.W. Bush. Why? Well, again, it's in response to a number of global transitions. Some major ones are when Hamas wins the Palestinian territory elections, and this is a major shock. I was in the administration at the time. It's a major strategic shock, and it calls into question this hope that elections are, a helpful precedent for democracy, and then when people take part in elections, they'll act responsibly, and good people will be elected rather than bad people like Hamas. But other things happen as well. Iraq, by this point, had gone from bad to worse, and the administration's strategic assumption in Iraq up until that point had been that political progress will lead to greater security and stability. And that's why there'd been a push for nationwide elections, parliamentary, and then electing a prime minister in Iraq, a couple rounds of nationwide elections. There had been pushes for, you know, reconciliation among the different parties and the Sunni and Shia in Iraq. And the hope had been that if we can get people engaged in the political process, then they'll stop killing each other. That hadn't worked. Iraq had gone from bad to worse. It really was in a state of all-out civil war by the summer of 2006. So on many fronts, the Bush himself and the other leaders in the administration realized that a lot of these previous strategic assumptions are not working, and so we need a new phase. So with Iraq, it starts with changing the assumption and reversing it. Now the strategic assumption being that security, provision of basic security, will need to precede political progress and reconciliation. Likewise, on the broader democracy and human rights front, there was not a complete abandonment of that, but it was relegated to a secondary priority in return for the need for just more stability first across the entire Middle East. This is also when the Lebanon War breaks out in 2006. And what had previously been a major push by the Bush administration on Hosni Mubarak to reform, to essentially democratize in Egypt, that's abandoned because Mubarak is needed to help, do regional diplomacy to restore stability and prevent a region-wide war emanating from Lebanon. Likewise, on the security front, in October of 2006, North Korea detonates their first nuclear device. I remember this very well because I was on my honeymoon in Tahiti at the time, trying to take a break from the National Security Council, and even there, the North Koreans had to ruin my honeymoon by setting off a nuclear bomb.
You were within range.
Yeah, it was. So anyway. And Iran makes major advances in its nuclear program as well. The Bush administration realized at that point that military action was not going to solve these problems, or at least decided they weren't. You know, with future events, this, of course, all this is debatable, but the strategic calculation is made, no, we need to pursue the diplomatic track. So that's why the six-party talks are launched with North Korea, the P5 plus one with Iran. And because of these new diplomatic initiatives with autocratic regimes, democracy and human rights, the larger freedom agenda, is set aside. So those are, I think, the four main phases of Bush administration foreign policy. Again, during Q&A, we can talk about if you think that is an accurate analysis and the strengths and weaknesses of those. And I can also point to a number of continuities across all 8 years. So this is not to say it's so schizophrenic that that the four have nothing in common, but I think they're pretty distinct. And as I said, the change from each phase is driven largely by external events, largely by these global transitions, and in turn, the president tried to respond. So then we come to the Obama foreign policy, the Obama presidential campaign, and then the foreign policy that President Obama has pursued since in office. And to give you a preview, I think that we've thus far seen three phases of Obama foreign policy. Maybe during his remaining 3 years we'll see another phase, so maybe there'll end up being four of those, but I'll walk you through how I think those work. To start, remember, all of us who followed the campaign, whether you're from London or anywhere else you were in the world, a lot of the Obama 2008 presidential campaign was based in part on a very vehement critique of the Bush foreign policy. Obama laid out a lot of things he was going to do, but if you wanted to boil it all down to one phrase, one sentence, is whatever Bush did, I'm going to do the opposite. And so the principles that Obama highlighted in his campaign were, you know, multilateral cooperation, improving America's image abroad, strengthening alliances, shifting the so-called war on terror into a legal framework rather than a military framework, negotiating unconditionally with rogue regimes and dictators, exiting Iraq while at the same time ramping up the war in Afghanistan. So Iraq is the bad war we're going to get out of there, and Afghanistan is the good war we're going to double down there. A strategic assumption that any progress in the Middle East on any front really depends first on progress in the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Then a sense that the U.S. should not be pushing democracy and human rights on other sovereign governments because that just annoys them. So how does this get implemented in practice? Well, I think the first phase of Obama administration foreign policy, just by coincidence, is about as long as the first phase of the Bush foreign policy. It's from inauguration until the fall of 2009. And we can call this hoping for change, borrowing his campaign slogan of hope and change. The two global transition points here are, one, the global financial crisis, of course, which also is a real strategic shock to the system, and then the end of the Bush presidency. And so what are the features? Well, a major outreach, major diplomatic outreach to Iran. Remember his holiday message to the Iranian people. Major outreach to the broader Muslim world, his June 2009 Cairo speech. Much more pressure on Israel to end settlement activity. The so-called reset with Russia, which was not just rhetorical, but also sought reducing or ending ballistic missile deployments in Poland and the Czech Republic and work for a new START agreement. The particularly coming out of the global financial crisis, there's a major outreach to China and an effort to create a G2 condominium where the U.S. and China, you know, the Obama administration essentially, you know, says to China, we'll disregard your autocracy and your human rights abuses, and we want you to be our main economic partner in helping to rescue and run the global economy. A major surge of troops in Afghanistan, the Copenhagen Climate Summit, et cetera. So these are all the major features of Obama foreign policy during this first 9 months. But then a second phase comes through. Now, I don't know if my friends in the Obama and White House would admit this, but this is what I think. I think that starting in the fall of 2009 and going for the next two years, we see a new phase of Obama foreign policy. And I call it, seriously, although it's a little cheeky, George Bush's third term. This is where I think we see a pretty major shift. What marks it? What are the transition points that create George Bush's third term in the Obama White House? Well, there's a number. First, there's the Green Movement in Iran. Remember the summer 2009 Green Movement protests. And this is right when the Obama administration is trying to do an outreach, the diplomatic outreach to the Iranian regime, and all of a sudden realize, wait, there may not be the stability we saw there. You know, shortly thereafter, there's the Arab awakening itself. But also, internally within the Obama administration, learning of more and more severe al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorist elements plots against the U.S. and against American interests. Essentially, a realization, wait, this terrorist threat is still more alive and stronger and more dangerous than we had thought before. There's the revelations of new Iranian uranium enrichment with the plant at Fordo, and a realization, maybe the earlier diplomatic outreach to Iran, the Iranians are not responding in good faith. Then there's also China becoming more aggressive. The hopes for the G2 with China don't work out so well when China starts alienating pretty much all of its neighbors through more aggressive territorial designs. So what are the features of this policy-wise when we actually see the change in Obama foreign policy? Well, we see a dramatic escalation in drone strikes, especially in Pakistan, but not confined there, also in Yemen and Somalia and elsewhere. Of course, we later see the operation against bin Laden himself, a unilateral preemptive strike that George Bush would have applauded. We see things like keeping Guantanamo Bay, the facility there, open after many promises to close it. We see in the initial responses to the Arab awakening, the Obama administration pressuring President Mubarak to step down. Then we see the Libya intervention, which I think we can summarize the Libya intervention thus, and this might be a controversial way to put it, but it's an American president making strong assertions of executive authority, saying I don't need congressional authorization, launching a war of choice in the Middle East against a brutal dictator with a history of WMD programs and supporting terrorism. So it sounds just like the Iraq War, right? May have had different window dressing, but a lot of the same
strategic. Right, without planning for the aftermath.
Without planning for the aftermath, that's right. So anyway, so like I said, if you change the name of the country but put some of the same features in, again, George Bush's third term. Then we see essentially abandoning the diplomatic outreach to Iran, but instead a stepped up campaign of pressure, covert cyber warfare, the Stuxnet virus, tightened sanctions, ominous warnings that all options are on the table, so threats of military force. We see a second surge of troops in Afghanistan, an implementation of a counterinsurgency strategy there similar to the one followed by the Bush administration in Iraq. And then we see the so-called pivot to Asia, of essentially telling American allies there, we're going to step up the American military presence in Asia, and without using the word containment, it's essentially a de facto containment policy of China. And then we also see, as corollaries to this, plummeting approval ratings for the United States in the broader Middle East and in the Muslim world, plummeting the depths even of the lowest days of the Bush administration. So that's what I think is largely the second phase of Obama foreign policy. But now, I think we're in a third phase. I think The third phase probably starts towards the end of 2011 or early 2012 and certainly has continued. And this is one we could call, borrowing the Obama administration's own formulation, leading from behind. What are the transition points here that caused the Obama administration to step back from its more assertive role on the global stage? Well, there's a number of them, mostly emanating from the Middle East. Syria turns very bloody, and the Obama administration decides to stay out of it. There's a sense of, okay, we had to intervene in Libya, but we're now making the decision that further interventions in destabilized Arab countries just don't work out very well for us. Egypt, of course, gets taken over by a Muslim, the erstwhile now Morsi government, but a Muslim Brotherhood government. Also a strategic shock to the system for the Obama administration, which dashed some of their earlier hopes for a more reformist government and a more peaceful transition there in Egypt. The Benghazi attacks in Libya, again, as alluded to by Jonathan earlier, again, a realization that the earlier interventions did not produce the positive outcomes and stable transitions that had hoped for. So all these together are very disillusioning for the Obama administration on the Arab awakening itself, but also on what they think American leadership and American foreign policy can even accomplish in the Middle East. Afghanistan stalls out. Essentially, the surge of troops and the counterinsurgency strategy there, they decide just hasn't worked, and they decide we're going to get out of Afghanistan now. Then, meanwhile, in terms of the global economic order, the weak American economic recovery at home limits American resources available for international leadership and engagements. And then the persistence of Eurozone weaknesses also limits Europe's partnership capabilities. So there's just retrenchment across the board in the Western world. Then Putin returns to power in Russia and starts acting like Putin again. It marks essentially the end of the reset. You don't hear anyone in Washington talk about the reset anymore except for in disdain and regret. And there's also a resurgence of Al-Qaeda, or perhaps Al-Qaeda never really went away, but it certainly seems to have mutated again into a number of regional affiliates. And some of the Obama administration's earlier hopes that the war on terror could be declared over, won, done with, poor Al-Qaeda defeated, you don't hear them talking about that either. So what are the specific policies? Much less interventionism, whether in Syria or Libya, sort of a hands-off approach to Egypt, renewed diplomatic outreach to Iran, drawdown in Afghanistan, major cuts to the Pentagon budget, and then even following the mantra in Washington and elsewhere that personnel is policy, the appointments of Chuck Hagel as Secretary of Defense and then John Kerry as Secretary of State, in the wake of the more interventionist-minded Leon Panetta and the more interventionist-minded Hillary Clinton, also show that President Obama has wanted to put his leadership team in place that will be consistent with his more restrained approach to American involvement in the world, the leading from behind or not leading at all. And finally, I think we've seen essentially the end of the Asia pivot. The Obama administration barely shows up in Asia anymore. The promised stepped-up military presence there has been more rhetorical than real. A lot of American Asian allies have decided that the United States does not have a major interest in Asia, but America's real interest is still back in the Middle East. So that's why I think we're in this third phase of Obama administration foreign policy. How long will this last? I don't know. A lot of it's going to depend on global events. A lot of it's going to depend on what happens with the Iranian nuclear program. A lot of it's going to depend on the possibility of more Chinese adventurism in Asia or not, whether that draws the U.S. back in. A lot of it's going to depend on future developments with North Korea and the very erratic regime there. A lot of it's going to depend on further developments, positive or negative, in Syria, and how the terrorist threat continues to mutate. So this might be the way the Obama administration wants to sail to the finish during its last three and a half years of office. Or we may, if there's future dramatic global transitions, we may see a return to a more interventionist American posture abroad. So just a couple closing thoughts on how we might make sense of all this or not. Last puzzle, why do American, if you do buy my argument that American presidents, that change in American foreign policy happens as much within administrations as across them, why so? I think there's a few reasons. One, for all the partisan rhetoric one encounters in American political campaigns, there actually still is a bipartisan tradition of continuity in American foreign policy. I think structurally the United States has followed more or less the same grand strategy since the end of World War II, really. And American presidents who inherit that strategic tradition largely continue it in the main pillars of it, even if they tweak it here and there. Second is the structure of government, similar to the UK, where most foreign policy, even if a new political team comes in at the top, most foreign policy is still done by the bureaucracy, by the career intelligence, the career military, the career diplomats, and the way governments themselves are structured are to follow certain continuities. And then likewise, just the realities and responsibilities of governing. When new presidents come into office, they don't feel nearly as bound by their campaign rhetoric as they do by just global events and the responsibilities of leadership and trying to make sense of the world as these transitions take place. In some particular cases, this may explain why a president will, and we see this throughout American history, will run for office denouncing his predecessor only to adopt a lot of those policies once in office. So a warning there to any of you planning on running for president of the United States: be careful what you say about the person before you, since you might end up looking like them if you win. So, anyway. But also, the presidents do change and adapt well in office. And if there may be some structural explanations for the continuities, I think there's also some explanations for the changes when they do take place. One is just learning and adapting. No one can prepare you for this job. It's the hardest job in the world, next to being Prime Minister of the UK. And presidents learn and adapt. And they may come into office with a certain set of ideas, but then once they seize the reins of power, once they have the responsibilities of office, and once they start seeing how global events take place, they learn and adapt. And at the end of the day, they're pretty pragmatic. And if a policy is not working, they'll change it and try another one. Another is just as the world can change, just as global events, whether democratic revolutions or civil wars or weapons of mass destruction proliferation, just as those can force a president to change a policy, the domestic politics can change as well. If there's a change of power in Congress, if there's an economic boom or an economic crisis, those can provide more or less latitude for an American president or even bandwidth for pursuing a foreign policy. And the corollary to that, of course, as the world changes, as new leaders come to power, as revolutions take place, presidents have to respond to this. So those are, I think, the factors that help account for some of these continuities and some of these changes.